Welcome to the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Kennedy, and you tune in today because you're sick of trying every fad diet under the sun and training yourself into the ground without seeing any results. That's why I'm here, to share the most effective ways to eat and train for sustainable and real results. Hey guys, welcome back to this week's episode of the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I've got a really enjoyable and educational episode today, chatting with Samuel and Jacob Skeppis from JPS Health and Fitness. We're talking about all things to do with progressive overload in regards to building lean muscle mass as an intermediate lifter, and specifically following a four-day training split. Now, for those of you that have heard any of my previous episodes with Jacob, you will know that he's very educated, he's very knowledgeable in the world of health and fitness, and so is Sam. It's a pleasure to have the boys on today, and make sure you hang around to the end of the episode to hear, in particular for trainers that are listening, about their educational work they're doing at the moment. But you're going to take a lot of value from today's episode, so if you do, please, please, please do take a screenshot of today's show and post it up on your Instagram story for me. Tag myself and tag the boys there. Their Instagram tags will be in the show notes below. I do really appreciate you tuning in to today's episode, and also so does the Bloom app. So for those of you that listened to last week's episode, I mentioned that we have jumped on board with the Bloom app as a sponsor for the health, the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast, which was founded by some friends of mine, Chloe Zepp and Molly Jane. They've both been living with some forms of depression and anxiety over the years, over the past few years, I guess, and have studied and found many different ways to help cope during these times, which is why they created the Bloom app, which I've been using for a while now. You guys would have heard me talk about on the podcast how I got into meditation back in 2017 for the very first time. January 1st, 2017, started meditating and made it a goal to meditate every single day. So it's definitely a part of my life. So when Chloe mentioned to me a while back that they were starting up the app Bloom, I was definitely keen to give it a try. And it's an amazing app. Focused on providing you with some tools to help you with the best, to become the best version of yourself and deal with the highs and lows that life can bring. Because as everybody would know that's listening, it's not all sunshine and rainbows as much as we'd like it to be. But I guess the aim of the Bloom app is you log in every day, you log in your mood. There's also an AI assistant that pops up and gives you a tool or activity that you can use that day that is based on your mood when you logged in, which I think is pretty cool, which is different to other apps. And then on top of that, there's also a library of hundreds of other tools that include meditation, obviously breath work, different types of yoga and mindful movements and different other forms of yoga as well. But the girls have done an exceptional job of the Bloom app. As I said, I like to use it daily. It's definitely a part of my daily routine, whether I get it done first thing in the morning as part of my morning routine or whether I do it a little later in the day as well. I think everybody can take some great benefit from the app, and you guys can actually try it yourself for free with a 7-day free trial. There's a link to the Bloom app in the show notes below. But I just wanted to say a big thank you to the girls for sponsoring the show. As you know, I only take any sponsors on board with the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast if they completely align with what I'm about, and I believe the girls do. So thanks so much to the Bloom app. As I said, give it a try. There's a link in the show notes below. You can try a 7-day free trial. I guarantee you will not regret it, and I'm sure you'll keep it as part of your daily routine, and it'll become part of your day-to-day schedule, I guess, and as I said, your routine. But it also helps you just make sure you're staying present and living in the moment, and also taking care of your mental health, because as we all know, it's just as important, if not more important, than our physical health. So a big thank you to the Bloom app. Now let's get stuck into the interview with you, which I did with the boys via Google Zoom. So I did this in my special podcast studio, aka the car, and the boys joined me from their gym. So I'm sure you'll take a lot of value from today's show. Make sure you hang around for the full episode. There's a lot of great content. And thanks again for tuning in today. Welcome to the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. Jacob, obviously you've been on the show before, mate. Sam, first time on. Thanks for joining me.
Long time listener. First time talker. Yeah,
that's it. How's your day been, boys?
Thank you. It's been pretty good
for me. Yeah.
So for those that are listening, these boys are are on separate mics, separate computers, sitting right next to each other. I'm in the professional DK Fitness studio, aka my car. So we've got a professional setup here today, but boys, we'll get stuck into it straight away. I obviously respect your time, and for those that are listening that haven't heard either of these boys talk before or don't know what they're about, go back and have a listen to some of the episodes I've done with Jacob, and also I'll have the link to all the socials and stuff in the show notes today if you go and check out their content and anything else they're working on, which we'll have a chat about later in the show. But as you guys would have seen from the title of today's podcast, what we're going to be talking about is how intermediate lifters can program effectively to overload and build muscle following specifically a four-day split. So for those that have no idea what that means, we're going to touch on that now. But if you're wondering what an intermediate lifter is, I would classify an intermediate lifter someone who's been training for, you know, to be honest, over 12 months. If you've been in the gym following a well-structured program or working with a coach for over 12 months and you've kind of passed that newbie gain stage, I would classify that as an intermediate lifter. I don't know how you boys would classify that, but firstly, I'd love to just get your thoughts, both of you, on what you'd classify as an intermediate lifter for those listening.
All right, I can give it a crack first. So I think like it's hard to attach time frames to like levels of advancement because like they don't necessarily like determine how far you're going to progress just because you've been training for a given period of time. I definitely would agree to an extent that's like if someone's been training pretty seriously and had a coach over a 12-month period, you're likely going to be seeing them to progressing towards that kind of intermediary stage. but in saying that, I've seen people who've trained for multiple years who still can't, you know, perform exercises with, you know, the right technique. It's like their understanding of like how to train and the application of effort in the gym just isn't there. And they still would be like kind of beginner as far as like actual advancement goes. Mm-hmm. So I think the way I would determine it, like with my lifters and people that I work with, is like once they're getting to a stage of like kind of competency and autonomy in their training, where from a coaching standpoint, you can nearly write them a training program and, you know, for the most part, they're able to execute it with the right level of intensity and effort pretty much on their own with very minimal guidance. And also, like, they're getting to a stage in their training where you have to be more structured and deliberate in the way you are, say, selecting exercises, planning kind of longer-term progression in their, you know, training box or, like, stacking together to make sure that you can facilitate progress because they're at a stage where it's like strength gains or like hypertrophy gains are slowing. Mm. But yeah, I would probably add in the requirement of some level of competency and autonomy on pretty much what you said.
Yeah. Awesome. Jacob, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, totally agree with Sam. I would echo all of those points, particularly that time in the gym is probably not a very good proxy for level of advancement, as you know, Danny, and I'm sure many of the listeners would be aware, just because somebody is in the gym training for X amount of time, year on year, doesn't necessarily mean that their level of advancement is indeed progressing to the intermediate stage. So the way that I like to classify an intermediate is somebody who has acquired most of the easy neural and morphological adaptations, so that is the develop the basic skills and, like Sam said, competencies around lifting, technique-wise, behavior-wise, so they've formed the habits necessary to be training consistently and consistently hard. And their rate of progression, which I think is a very good proxy for when somebody edges out of the beginner stages of their training career, because no longer are they progressing from session to session as they would have when they were a beginner, but they are now progressing fortnightly to monthly. So they're seeing improvements in terms of being able to add reps, load to the bar every fortnight, potentially monthly. So that would scale across the intermediate stage, where if somebody's an early intermediate, they'd still be able to progress maybe every week, every fortnight, And as they get to the latter stages of that intermediate phase, they might see progress fortnightly to monthly, and then they'd be into the advanced stages. And obviously there's a lot of commonalities amongst intermediate lifters that sort of bottleneck their progression from the early to late intermediate stages and then onto the advanced level of their training career. And we'll get into those, no doubt.
Yeah, and just staying on the theme of overloading, you mentioned a few different ways that we can overload there. For those that are listening that are in that intermediate stage, and you know, you probably are at that point now where you might not be able to be increasing the load on the bar as often as you'd like, increasing the amount of reps you're doing for a certain weight and whatnot, and the amount of volume you're doing. So you're probably getting stuck with ideas of how you can continue to overload, especially, you know, staying specific to the 4-day training split, which we're going to talk about today. So I'll get you both to share your thoughts here on just different ways that those that are listening can continue to overload and what they should be focusing on moving forward. Because, you know, especially in that first initial stages of lifting, when you are seeing those newbie gains, it's exciting when, you know, almost every week you're seeing your numbers go up, or you're getting more reps out. It might be doing pull-ups and you're seeing your progress, you know, go through the roof like almost weekly, which is exciting and it's fun. And even body composition wise, you can see big differences. But once you reach that point where it starts to slow down, it can be hard to maintain motivation and also know what to expect, especially if you've only just been training properly for a shortish period of time. So in regards to overload, what can we expect? Like, what should we be kind of gauging as overload, and how can we mix things up with our lifts and movements and different techniques of programming to make sure we are overloading over time still?
Yeah, Samuel, you want to?
Oh, you want me to start? I can do that. Just some things like I kind of noted down, like while you're just talking there, Danny. I think, like, firstly, it's very important for like these intermediate lifters or people who are entering kind of that stage of their lifting to just remember that it's like it is important to be patient and like you said, not to get demotivated or disheartened when the results do slow, and to make sure that you kind of are still putting the work in. And it's not necessarily like that you absolutely have to overload every single exercise, every single session, but just a matter of that you are continuing to overload over time and doing that consistently, you know, and patience is a hard sell, telling people that it's going to take time, especially when they've just, like, you know, finished making this, say, like they're coming out of that newbie gain stage and they've been like seeing great progress and then it starts to slow. It's like, oh, what the hell's going on? Why I'm progressing? Just making sure that, I suppose, from a coaching standpoint, that you're communicating that, it's like this is kind of where you really need to start focusing on those long-term goals. And then secondarily, like how we're going to assess like progress becomes even more important, because it's like, as kind of you guys both have mentioned, it's like we're no longer making, you know, incremental gains every single week. We're not adding weights to the bar. We're not increasing reps. It's just, you know, assessing things like, say, total volume for a muscle group over a week and calculating that. For example. But other ways that I like to kind of overload with more intermediate lifters, I don't think that, well, for the most part, Jacob, you can comment on this. I think for a lot of intermediate lifters, they probably want to like really get specific and like do like specification or like, you know, kind of focus blocks probably too early. I just think when you're, especially let's just say you're like keeping in mind the demographic, let's say someone who's entering that intermediate stage, the results are slowing and they kind of, it's like, we need to work out a way to continually to progress them. It's like with working on a 4-day program, it's like, you probably don't need to start going into like, oh, let's do a shoulder specific block, you know, for the next 4 to 6 weeks. And then we're going to go into like a chest block. Someone who's only just becoming an intermediate is still probably going to make decent progress provided, exercise selection and the actual program design is, you know, down pat. I think just making sure that it's like the volume is like, presuming we're training for hypertrophy, like the volume is staying like quite high and working in within those kind of hypertrophic ranges where it's like we're hitting, you know, 10 to like kind of 15 sets like at a muscle on, let's say, a particular muscle group, and we're doing that, you know, getting 2 to 3 exposures in a week, So I think a good way to do that is to, instead of having like, let's say an upper push day and then an upper pull day and like two lower body days, and that's our 4 day split. Like intermediates can still very much utilize things like full body days where they can get more high quality exposure by using, say, more compound or like kind of bang for buck movements, but structuring in a way that facilitates that. Instead of doing all chest one day, all back another day, it's like you could go bench press one day and then you have like an incline dumbbell press on another day, and then you might have one day where there's no chest work and then another day where you're doing some like, you know, close grip bench press or dips or something like that. It's like now you have three exposures in your 4 day program. It's like we're kind of still able to get some hard like and heavy work in, but we're still getting a lot of frequent exposures as well.
Yeah.
And then kind of second to that, I'll just say it's like making sure that exercise selection is kind of is down pat. If you're working within constraints of having only 4 training days, maybe you need to, like, again, 4 training days is quite a bit, but presuming people have time constraints as well, like we're not, you don't want people just spending 3 hours in the gym to make sure that they're hitting these kind of volume targets. So it's kind of then how are we going to get that volume in? What are those exercises going to look like? If you had an intermediate lifter, maybe you're not doing things like, you know, push-ups or like really specific isolation movements, but
yeah,
focusing more, as I said, like on those kind of compound bang for your buck movements. Yes, maybe a lot of bench pressing, doing say deficit work where it's like you can, you know, say do incline dumbbell press, increase the range of motion, and just, yeah, not kind of taking away, I think. It's like making sure you're just using more deliberate exercise selection, because I'm sure we, it's like you guys can tell me, probably all agree that when you have a beginner, you can probably get them doing, like, let's just say using chest for an example, because who doesn't love chest? Like you get them on a flat dumbbell press and it's like, yeah, they'll progress pretty much linearly for, you know, weeks, months on end. It's like, that's probably not enough for someone who's getting into the intermediate stage, but that doesn't mean they can't get you to just dumbbell press. Just maybe you need to make it more challenging, and you can do things like, oh, we're going to pause. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much that answers the question, but I think like selecting appropriate exercises and making sure that you're getting enough exposures to those exercises is going to be probably the most important thing to ensure intermediates are still progressing.
Yeah, I really, really strongly agree there. And you touched on how many times you're exposing that muscle to a stimulus each week. Like, I always preach, in my opinion, I think that, you know, at least twice per week frequency, each muscle group, in my opinion, is the most beneficial. But are you, like, would you recommend even more? So, like, I know you just touched on then possibly even 3 times per week. Like, in regards to the actual training split, what would you say would be one of the more effective ways to break it up? Like 2 upper body days, 2 lower body days, or you mentioned full body. Would you be going as far as doing 4 full body days?
Well, it really, it's like, yeah, honestly, program design and exercise selection is so unique that it's very hard to give it like the definitive, this is going to be great, because obviously everyone's different. Like, and again, how long you can spend in the gym is also going to be a confounding factor. But if someone's only able to train 4 days a week and they really think that their progress is kind of like slowing, it's like you could get them doing like exposure to say all main muscle groups 3 times a week and do full body splits, or maybe you do like a full upper body day with some additional, you know, quads at the end, right?
Yeah.
It's like maybe that's that one extra exposure to the quads that's going to like kind of get them some further volume. But you always have to remember, you can't just continue to add training volume in. It's like people can't just recover indefinitely. So if they're an intermediate and they go, oh, well, you know, I want to still develop my whole physique, and I would say that's probably a good way to approach it. We're not, again, focalization blocks. Maybe instead of doing bicep curls at the end, because again, let's say we only have an hour, right? And we want to go, okay, I want to get some extra back work in. Maybe we have to give up on biceps, but maybe we can get the biceps by doing like an underhand lat pull down or an underhand seated row. Still going to target the biceps, but we're getting more out of that exercise for the back as well. So we've kind of traded up for something that is going to fit within time constraints, fit within our limitations on how many days we're training a week, whilst also ticking the boxes of being a challenging movement that's going to target the back and biceps.
Yeah, and probably be able to lift more load as well.
Yeah, exactly. Jacob, what do you, I suppose, have to say? Feel free to disagree.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut out a little bit there. Is the baton being passed over to me?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. So, yeah, I agree with everything that Samuel said there in terms of the exposure to the exercises and whatnot. But I think it's also important to discuss what the priorities are for an intermediate lifter. So, again, looking at what I mentioned earlier, where intermediates have acquired those very competencies and adaptations. The priorities when they do enter the intermediate phase are to increase muscle size, and obviously that's going to be specific to each individual. So whether somebody wants to prioritize developing their chest, their back, their legs, their glutes, so on and so forth. Also their work capacity, so their ability to tolerate more work, as well as learning to accurately gauge effort using RPE and RIR scales. Understanding the importance of rest and recovery is a huge concern and priority for the intermediate lifter, because one of the bottlenecks that really impedes their ability to progress into the late intermediate and early advanced stages is overtraining for the most part, because most intermediates will start to be able to work really, really hard. They'll be able to impose quite a bit of stress, but they also need to learn the skill of recovering. So this is where incorporating heavy and hard sessions, lighter sessions. So as we mentioned, if we're getting frequent exposure to exercises and they're training each muscle group, say 2 to 3 times a week, not all of those sessions can be of the same difficulty in terms of volume and intensity. So we'll need to have a little bit more undulation in the training stress. And this is where daily undulating periodization is a really beneficial and useful strategy. And they also need to start taking deloads more frequently. So as a beginner, you generally won't need to deload for quite a while. Beginners can get away with 12, 16 weeks, sometimes longer periods without having to deload, because they're just continually adapting, and the stress is within their recovery capabilities, and they've got the adaptive resources to go towards recovering from the training stress. And a huge factor for intermediates in terms of their priorities is going to be consistency. So avoiding program hopping, which is what we see very commonly with your intermediates. So because they start becoming a little bit impatient, the rate of progress and gain slows down exponentially. So they're no longer seeing progress from session to session, week to week. They can become quite frustrated, and their expectations don't align with their ability to progress. So you'll see them constantly hopping from one program to another and looking for the next best thing or solution. And this is obviously quite detrimental to their progress. So with that out of the way, we need to really start to monitor training volume a little bit more closely, making sure that the dose of the stimulus is appropriate to drive adaptations, but also within the recovery capacity of the individual. And once we get the volume set, so generally anywhere from 10 to 20 sets per week per muscle group, we can split that over 2 to 3 sessions within that training week, we need to look at progressing the stimulus based on adaptation. So drawing things full circle now to your original question with overload for intermediates, we need to remember and define what progressive overload is. So when we look at progressive overload, it's the logical and sequential increase in the training stress, right? So it means we're making training more and more difficult. And most people, when they think of progressive overload, will think of Socrates when he's, you know, carrying the bull up the hill, and it's a baby bull initially, and as the bull gets bigger and bigger and bigger, he gets bigger and bigger as well. And what a lot of people think of when we talk about progressive overload is that they need to force overload. They need to train harder and harder and overload their training so that they get adaptations. But this is in reverse of how we should perceive progressive overload, because the overload in the stimulus needs to be disruptive. It needs to be stressful enough to drive an adaptation, but it also needs to be within the adaptive potential of the system. So what that means is we don't actually force overload, but instead we need to conceptualize overload as observable progression in performance and the overall stimulus as a result of prior adaptation. An observation than an action. So as the action is meeting or exceeding the required overload stimulus within a session. So for example, if you perform more work, such as lifting more weight or performing the same work and weight with lower effort, adaptation has occurred. So if we think about this in just a really practical sense, you're doing a squat, you do three sets of eight at 100 kilos at an RP 8, and you want to meet the next week an RP of 8 for three sets of 8. And if you have adapted to that stimulus and you do three sets of 8 at 100 kilos again, but the RP is a 7, that means that adaptations have occurred and you need to overload to stay at an RP 8 because of those adaptations. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
So I think once we get the dose of the stimulus right and we get the intensity within the threshold of where it needs to be to build muscle, because again, that's the primary objective when we're working with intermediate athletes. So we need an RP of 5 or more on average, or an RIR of 5 or less. We need to be training with 10 to 20 sets per week, split across 2 to 3 sessions, aiming for probably no more than 10 sets per muscle group within a session, so the quality of work can be maintained. Yep. We then just need to let adaptations come to us, and we increase the difficulty of the training stress by adding reps or adding load as we progress.
Awesome. There's some really good takeaways there. And I think, you know, what I find as well is that it's almost, especially when you've got people that come to you that have started training or even may have been training for an extended period of time. And like we've touched on already, even though they have been training for an extended period of time, their level of, their patterning with their movements and stuff is still at a beginner's level. So once we eventually teach them how to improve that and they start to reach that intermediate stage, it's almost like hard to explain to people that instead of going from a session where you've just overloaded the shit out of your chest for an hour and you feel like you've just obliterated that muscle group to the point where you're not going to train it again for a week, where it's so much more beneficial, as you've touched on as well, Sam, to split that over multiple sessions per week, where the quality of those lifts is going to be so much higher. The overall load for that week is going to be so much higher. And once you can wrap people's head around that, I think, and change the mindset to quality over quantity, that's when the real results start to happen. I know for myself, like I saw that firsthand. Like I would just go in and try and train to pretty much failure. And, whether it was once or twice on each muscle group per week, I didn't really start to see any benefit from actual lean muscle gain until obviously I aligned my calorie intake with what I was trying to do, but also the quality of the sets that I was doing and the amount of load I was lifting per week, and knowing that I didn't have to leave every single session feeling like, you know, I'd absolutely obliterated my lats or my quads were completely fried because I'd absolutely smashed him in that one session.
Yeah, a lot of good points there, Danny. I just want to bring two things up really quickly. One is on per session volume. So as you mentioned, like a lot of beginners who come into the intermediate stage and think they just need to go harder and harder, do more and more work within a session for a given muscle group. James Krieger's in-house meta-analysis that he's conducted on Weightology weekly, which is his research review, found that per session volumes will see peak hypertrophy at around 8 to 10 sets within a workout, where that's where I got that recommendation, probably no more than 10 sets per workout per muscle group. And any more volume than that is associated with regression and plateau, otherwise known as junk volume. So really good points that you raised there on the quality of work over the quantity, because more isn't always better. There is a cap on how much volume we can do within a session that will be productive. And the way that I like to think about this is it's analogous to flogging a dead horse, right? Once the horse is dead, you can keep flogging it, but it's not going to go anywhere, right? So if you're doing more than 10 sets within a workout, for the most part, anything over that is just digging a deeper recovery hole that will to adapt, because we don't get adapted without recovery. So recovery being a return to baseline in performance. So you typically won't be recovered if you can no longer perform the same workload as you did in the previous session. So the more work you do in a session doesn't always mean that you're going to get more adaptations. You'll only get more adaptations if you're recovering from that work by the next time that you induce that same training stress. And the second point that I wanted to bring up there that you raised was having your nutrition align with your current training goals. And I think as an intermediate, you can no longer recomposition in the same way that a beginner can. So a beginner can build muscle and lose fat simultaneously because the stimulus is so novel that they can achieve fat loss and muscle growth at the same time. As a beginner, you really need to start having more dedicated and focused training cycles. So if your objective is to build muscle, not only do you need to focus on getting your training structure set up in a way that will allow you to progress, but you also need to facilitate adaptations via nutrition. And nutrition won't cause adaptations in and of itself. It simply augments the adaptations from the training stress. So we need to be making sure that we're eating at a small calorie surplus to build muscle at an appreciable rate. We want to be aiming for at least 0.25 to 0.5% of weight gain per week. Any more than that, you're getting fat. Any less, it's going to be super hard to detect and non-practical. So being at a generally 200 to 500 calorie surplus per day is going to be beneficial. Making sure that you're getting your protein intake at least 1.8 to 2.2 grams per kg of body weight, having your fat intake no lower than 0.5 grams per kg of body weight, and any leftover calories once you've set protein, once you've set fat, should be coming from carbohydrates to meet the calorie surplus that you're wanting to create to build muscle.
Awesome. Now, well, I've got a number of questions that I want to quickly get through here that I put up a bit of a story on Instagram last night for people to send through some questions, and we got heaps, but obviously respecting both of your time here, I want to pick out a few of the better ones, kind of align with what we're talking about. And then also I want to get into a little bit of stuff that you guys are doing with some education side of things as well. So you've already touched on a little bit there, Jacob, but I'll get you both to just almost give me a bit of a short answer to some of these questions, and I'll kind of power through them. So the first one was actually aligned with nutrition. And the question was, is it still possible to gain muscle if you're lifting, if you're progressively overloading with your strength training, but you're in a calorie deficit? So I'll get you both to give me, I know we could talk about this shit for a long, long time, and I know it's going to be hard for both of you to give me a short answer because you're both got so much knowledge on these topics, but we'll try and keep it relatively short.
Jacob, do you want to go first?
You want me to go first?
You go.
I'll go first this time. All right. So can you build muscle and lose fat at the same time? Is that fundamentally the question, Danny?
Can you gain muscle by eating in a calorie deficit if you are still overloading your training?
Okay. So I would say there's probably four situations where that can happen. So when you're eating less calories than your body requires to maintain its current weight, the first is if you're a beginner. So when you're a beginner, the rate of adaptation in terms of muscle growth is quite fast, and your ability to progress in terms of muscle size is quite high. So you can eat at a calorie deficit and still build muscle as a beginner. Also, if you're obese, because fat is generally protective of muscle loss, so eating at a calorie deficit, if you have exponential or significant amounts of body fat can still occur if you get the training stimulus right. The third is if you're returning from a layoff, meaning that you're coming back from training after taking some time away. And the reason for this is that you don't, whilst you might lose muscle size, that's just the fibers shrinking. You actually maintain all of the satellite cells within the muscle. And this is what is known as the muscle memory effect. So basically, you've got all of the infrastructure within the muscle to rapidly increase the fiber size back to where it was prior to ceasing training. So you can eat at a calorie deficit and still build back all the muscle that you lost if you're returning from a break from training. And the fourth is if you're on that there Mexican supplements. So if you're supplementing with exogenous hormones such as testosterone, all of these sorts of things, you can eat a calorie deficit and build size.
Great. Sam, what are your thoughts?
I don't think I really need to add anything further than that. I think that's a pretty concise summary.
If you're an intermediate and you're trying to build muscle, you should not be eating calorie deficit, period.
Yeah, that would be the only thing I would have added.
Just spin your wheels.
Perfect.
If you're trying to lose weight, you should be focusing on that and preserving muscle, not trying to gain it, and just survive and then reset your goals.
Yeah, and that's a comment. I'm sure you guys get this a lot as well, particularly with new clients or even just questions on social media about people constantly wanting to achieve two goals at the same time, two of the opposite goals pretty much, build muscle mass and lose fat at the same time. And like you said, there are a number of certain situations where that can happen, but the likelihood, especially if we're talking at the moment, if our audience is intermediate lifters, it's just not going to happen.
Very, very slim chance. It's probably not the best way to go about it.
Not at all. Next question is, can you be, so we've talked about the minimum amount of protein we need to be eating in regards to being in a calorie surplus or even deficit for that matter. Is there a point where you're eating too much protein and it's just not going to give you any extra benefit, or if or even possibly can it be detrimental to progress by eating too much protein?
I'll try and tackle this one. So I can't remember who I was listening to. I think it might've been Stronger by Science podcast a while ago. They were talking about like Eric Trexler and Greg Knuckles were talking about, there was a study done where there were people eating like an absurd amount of, like, it was just like 4 grams per like kilogram of muscle mass or something like that. It was a lot of protein. It's like, and they weren't experiencing any like deleterious like health effects from my recollection. Don't quote me on that necessarily. And again, if my memory serves, it's like once you get past probably, you know, that kind of like holy grail 2.2, like that's the magical amount of protein. Really, once you're kind of getting further beyond that, I don't think you're seeing any further benefit. Not that there's necessarily going to be any health implications. There could be if you were like monitoring, I suppose, calories, and that meant that you were taking food away from like fats. So let's say you were going super low on fats to try and get protein in because you still wanted carbs as well. Like that might have negative health implications and not be worth it. But for the most part, like you can probably eat as much protein as you really can stomach without experiencing too many health complications. I wouldn't recommend it. I don't think it's necessary.
Awesome.
That's my summary.
Jacob, so, did you want to add anything to that? Or?
Yeah, so a study by Ribeiro and others in 2019 kind of summarized protein intake for hypertrophy really, really well. And they stated in regards to muscle hypertrophy, it's prudent to consume at least 2.2 grams per kg of body weight per day. And they also mentioned that there's no apparent downsides to consuming somewhat higher amounts of protein from a muscle building standpoint, because any amino acids aren't used for anabolism, so that is generating meaning that you piss out. Really favorable risk to reward ratio of having a little bit more energy.
Sorry, mate.
Obviously, ensuring that your protein is of high quality. So just making sure that you have high quality protein in your diet. So you're getting all the essential amino acids, particularly leucine, as that is regulating mTOR, which is very important for governing the muscle hypertrophy process. And whether you need more protein in higher volume phases, I would say there's probably a good idea. That hypothesis is untested currently. But if you're doing higher volumes of training, it might be a good idea to jack your protein up just marginally. When it comes to fat loss, you know, serious fat loss phases such as a contest prep for bodybuilders to maintain muscle mass while losing body fat. Helms did a study, a meta-analysis a while back, where he suggested an intake of 2.3 to 3.1 kilos, grams of protein, sorry, per kilo a day in resistance training individuals. So it's a good idea to probably scale your protein up a little bit if you're dieting for fat loss, especially if you're already lean. So that would be my take on protein for building muscle.
Perfect. Well, we've got two more here. And as I said, I want to touch on the education side of things. So the next one we have here is, who can do the most chin-ups out of you two guys?
Definitely Sam.
Awesome.
My legs would be up.
Sorry, I've got a lot more.
My stomach is smaller.
All right, guys, before we get into the education, this will kind of lead into it. Could we get three tips from you each on becoming a successful trainer? And then once we've done that, like I said, I want you guys to talk a little bit about your mentorship program and what that includes.
Yeah, Sam, take it away.
All right. Let me think. Three tips on becoming a successful personal trainer. One that I always recommend, like we have a lot of students come through here. We facilitate like certificate 3 and 4 through a regulatory body, which is pretty cool. But we have a lot of students like even coming from universities and stuff who are like, yes, we want to get into like coaching or they want to get into sports science or whatever it is. I think prioritizing your like communication skills and your ability to work with people, as much as you prioritize understanding kind of the fundamentals of like coaching and like nutrition, like training, is probably a good starting point, because as I'm sure you both would probably agree, working with people is not necessarily easy. It's a tricky industry. You're working with a lot of different people who have a lot of different needs, come from different backgrounds, and having an ability to communicate with a disparate amount of like or disparate people from, you know, different walks of life is really important. It doesn't matter if you know all the information, you can give people like verbatim citations of, you know, studies about why they should train X amount per week because, you know, it's great for glute hypertrophy or whatever. They don't care about that, but you need to be able to communicate the that information in a way that they're going to buy into it and they're going to understand it and then go, okay, this is in my interest and they're going to go ahead with it. So I think prioritizing communication skills and getting some hands-on and practical experience actually working with people. And then this ties into my second tip, which would be, it's like be willing to do free work. Like I couldn't tell you how many times it's just like, you know, help people out with like technique on the gym floor. It's like, you can't, the money will look after itself. If you are good at what you do. So be open to, especially when you're starting out, be open to just working and honing your skills and working on your craft of coaching and working with people and getting them results. Because at the end of the day, if you can demonstrate to people pretty much, you know, with a very high success rate that you can do that, then people will be willing to pay you and people will buy into that. But if you're just charging and you have no skills and you have no like kind of evidence supporting your ability to do what you're saying you can do, it just falls on deaf ears. So I think
it's like, building up that trust, isn't it? It's the same with content like we're doing now and things through social media and maybe email marketing, whatever it is. It's all about building up trust and giving you know, your target audience, your target clients, your niche, whatever, a reason to come to you in the first place. If you've given them so much value to the point where whenever they think of something that they need to pay for, they want a service that they're more than willing to pay you because they know that you've given them value in the past and they trust you, then you've done your job. Like, regardless of whether, you know, you've had to pay for your education, which obviously a lot of people do, if you're worried about giving away information for free because you think you should be paid for it, then you're not going to get paid for it because no one's going to come to you. They don't have any reason to pay you for your services in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. Like, kind of, that's a great like summation of the point. It's like you need to build your skills and your like your experience, and you can only do that by doing work, and you can't just expect to be paid, you know, top dollar from the start. So, you know, I used to program for friends. I still program for friends, and it's like it's just that is just an opportunity. And it's like if they don't pay, that's fine. I don't care because it's an opportunity for me to like try new things out as a coach. I can be like, we're gonna just trial something slightly different and see how you respond. Yep. It's an opportunity to like not only help people, which is, you know, that's why I got into this.
Yeah.
It's okay. Like that's what I get the most out of, you know, working with people and seeing them progress and get to where they want to be. But also it's an opportunity for me to learn and get better at my craft. And then if I can get better, then I can help more people. And then inherently, again, it's like the career side of things will look after itself.
Yeah.
A third tip would be, that's a tough one.
three tips. Yeah, it should be really easy, but I'm trying to think of something that's actually going to be valuable. We're going to talk about education, but I think continuing to educate is really important. I'll be up there. I think coaches shouldn't just do like their cert 3 and 4 or something, some course, and then go, I have all the answers, and presume that they are, ready to go and help people. It's important to acknowledge the fact that you can only know so much and you can only have so much information. So go and upskill and, seek further education so you can help people more and do a better job at doing that. But also in the same kind of token, it's like you should really be pursuing further education in areas that are relevant to what you're doing. It's all well and good to, want to be broaden your kind of education and knowledge base. And I think that's really important. But we just, from like an industry standpoint, we need to all be very careful not to like venture too far out of our scope of practice.
Yeah.
I put a post up about this the other day. It's just like people will come to me and ask me questions. And if I don't know the answer, that happens very often about training and nutrition, or like, very specific stuff. It's like I'll direct them to another JPS coach who has further education or has studied that.
Yeah, it's almost like trying to be the jack of all trades.
Yeah, I think there's a certain base, a kind of foundational knowledge that all coaches should have, in order to succeed within the industry. That it's just like kind of fundamentally required. Pursuing like higher or further education kind of just because isn't going to do you any favors, and pursuing it in areas that don't relate to your career, right, whatever that may be, is also maybe not as valuable as like kind of staying in your lane and just going, I'm going to continue to like work on and upskill in my area.
Yeah.
But
I couldn't agree more.
Education is important. Continue to do it. Just make sure you're being deliberate in where you're educating and upskilling and where it's coming from. Like if a personal trainer came to me and said, oh, I'm thinking of doing a master's, right, in university, I would be like, unless that is required for your long-term goal and career, it's not necessary. But if it's something you want to do and it's like an interest of yours and it's like you want to create this niche down the track, go for it, right? And it's like that's where people need to draw that distinction and actually be a little bit more critical in assessing kind of what they're doing for their upskilling and education.
Yep, awesome.
But yeah, that's me. Three tips.
Jacob, confirm that they are very, very good tips and a lot of nuggets for coaches to take from what Samuel had to say. I have conceptualized coach development as having five pillars for success. So the first is knowing your client. So having systems and the ability through your communication skills and interpersonal skills to be able to get to know your client and know them like the back of your hand. I think that's super important. And obviously enhancing that skill is critical if you want to be successful. And the second is to know the training and nutrition principles. And I couldn't recommend a book any more highly than The Muscle and Strength Pyramids by Eric Helms, Andrea Valdez, and Andy Morgan. So I suggest that coaches go ahead and read that. The third is to create systems for coaching. So when I say systems for coaching, what I mean is having methods, processes, and procedures that are designed to organize and structure your coaching of a client. So purposefully carrying out the activities involved with coaching, whether it's screening, program writing, updating your clients, taking a consultation, all of those sorts of things, so that you can have a very systematic approach to streamline the coaching process. So when we look at creating systems, we want to focus on having the principles govern how we go about that. We need organization and planning, having some purpose and structure. They've got to be logical. Simplicity is always better than complexity. You've got to have means of assessing outcomes and over time modify and refine your coaching systems, and also think about the delivery and communication to the client within that process. So the language you use, how you categorize things, whether it's a training cycle, a training block, like the terminology that you use so that you can convey the message to them. And the fourth is enhancing your skills, your knowledge and your experience. So knowing what skills you need, the knowledge you require, where there's gaps in your knowledge, what you can learn from your current and previous experiences, and not just thinking of experience as tenure, so the duration that you're coaching, but more so the quality of work that you're doing within that, that's obviously facilitating, you know, results. And then looking at how you can enhance your skills. So all the skills that you require as a coach, whether it's communication, the interpersonal stuff, whether it's the tactile elements of coaching and being able to teach technique and movements in the gym and modify and explain them, all those sorts of things. And then the fifth is developing competent lifters. And I think this is hugely overlooked, but there are four things within this that coaches should focus on. And that is teaching their clients to become competent. So that is that they can go into the gym, they can lift on their own, they can follow a program, they can train without the reliance of a coach. And I think while that seems counterintuitive at a glance, it's hugely beneficial long term, because you want to be able to train your clients to a point where they no longer need you, because then you can work with more people. They're going to be great marketing tools in and of themselves. And they are, you know, as we know, word of mouth is very, very potent and powerful means of marketing. The second point within developing competent lifters is giving your clients confidence. So the self-belief, resilience, and mental toughness they need to train hard, recover, and manage themselves within you know, their goals, and also increasing their sense of positive self-worth. And then the third point within competent lifters is connection. So teaching your clients how to develop interpersonal skills and the ability to build and sustain meaningful and positive relationships with other people in the gym. You can think about it like a spider web. If your clients have just one connection to the gym and that gym community, that's you, it's very easy to cut that tie and stop, you know, going back to the gym and, you know, connecting with you, for example, the coach. But if they have multiple connections, meaning that it's like a spider web, it's a lot harder to break all of those ties. So if they're friends with other clients or members in the gym, I think that can be very beneficial for long-term development of a client. And the fourth point in developing competent clients is character. So teaching your athletes, your lifters, and your clients to respect the gym, respect the process, to act with integrity, develop self-discipline, and, you know, make decisions in an ethical and moral way as it relates to their diet, their training, and their life in general can be super beneficial. So they would be the things that I would recommend coaches focus on. And as it will relate to what we're going to discuss next, and a segue into that smoothly, I think continually striving for progress as a coach is very, very important, because if you're not improving, you're staying idle, you'll potentially regress, you'll fall by the wayside, and there'll be plenty of other coaches who will be better than you and more sought after.
Can I also add in one last thing?
Yeah, mate.
I also think that last tip, and I don't recall Jacob mentioning it, just something that all coaches should be doing is practicing what they preach and leading by example.
Yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned that, Jacob, but yeah, if you're not taking your training seriously, if you don't kind of, you know, monitor your nutrition, I'm not saying you need to have abs all year round or, you know, do anything, but I think at the end of the day, it's like your clients kind of look up to you. So it's important to be a role model and someone worth looking up to, someone who is actually, you know, aspiring them to be better as well. I think if you can, yeah, do that and take your own training, nutrition and health seriously, then they will, and just live a life that they can kind of aspire to. Not to say you're going to be you know, an absolute role model, but just, yeah, take it seriously, and then hopefully they will too.
Amazing. Yeah,
I just want to add one more thing because Samuel brought up a really good point. Yeah, a lot of people would have heard the saying, you know, you've got to practice what you preach, right? And I think as a new and upcoming coach, it's integral to practice what you preach to some degree. You don't need to have abs year round, but you if you're going to tell your clients how to diet for fat loss, you should have some experience in dieting for fat loss. So you shouldn't be too out of shape. I think as you progress as a coach over the years and you have exemplified, you know, walking the walk and not just talking the talk, I think you can get away with a little bit more. You don't need to always practice what you preach because you've demonstrated that you have done so in the past. I think early on when you're still trying to crack into the industry and make a name for yourself, practicing what you preach is a very, very powerful way to create buy-in, trust, and to demonstrate you know what the fuck you're doing.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And there's so much value there for those that are aspiring to be trainers, but also obviously throughout this whole episode, for anybody listening, not just intermediate lifters, even for those that are just beginning and that have, you know, are listening to this for something to look forward to as they progress through in their career. And I think it's also just great for anybody listening, even if you are an advanced lifter, just to hear these things again and kind of just touch up on what's really important in terms of programming and what we should be focusing on, regardless of whether it's a 4-day split or whether we're following our own program. But we do have to wrap things up. So before I do that, guys, I'm happy for one of you to talk about this. I wanted you to have a bit of a talk about the JPS Health and Fitness education side of things and how those that are listening that are trainers can further their education by working with you guys and just a bit of information on that and how they can get access to it. Obviously, I'll have any links to any further information and whatnot in the show notes below. But yeah, happy for one of you guys to fire away.
Go for it, Samuel.
All right. So I'll try and keep this under 2 minutes because you have to go, Danny. So we started educating people, educating coaches, because frankly they saw that you know, we were doing a good job with our clients. So you know, we started to get more and more coaches interested in working with us to improve their skills and to learn. Over time, that kind of morphed into, you know, various workshops, things like that, to now where we have JPS education, which is a very large focus of what we do. Pretty much the sole intention of our education stream from the business is that there is only so many clients, so many individuals that we at JPS can help, be that in person who can access our facility or online via our services. So JPS education is really a means for us to, as our kind of like slogan suggests, raise the standard of the industry. It's very, I think a lot of people would echo the same kind of entrance to the industry, you know, gone through a Cert 3 and 4 or some kind of study and it wasn't really that great, didn't really prepare them for the industry, and then they're kind of left in the lurch when they actually start. And that's why we have such a high turnover rate, and just in general the profession of, say, being a coach or a personal trainer is, you know, something that's not taken very seriously. So kind of where we come in, over the last, you know, between Jacob and I, we have nearly 20 years of experience, not to mention all of our other coaches, you know, Lyndon Purcell, you know, who's completing his master's, Martin Rafala, and our team of coaches. We're pretty much just trying to offer further education, upskilling opportunities for coaches and people who are just generally interested in their lifting, so that we can, over time, build the quality of coaches that are out there in kind of practicing in the industry at large within Australia and around the world. So, you know, our main kind of education service would be our online mentorship. The February intake has just kicked off as of Monday. That is a pretty comprehensive course. It covers a lot of the stuff that it covers a lot of the gaps in, say, other education courses, because it's predominantly built from people who are actually practicing in the industry, which is really important because most people want practical, hands-on, useful information. And that's really what we're trying to do with JPS education. We have a number of workshops and stuff available. It's like we run conferences. Again, really just to kind of spread the good word of, you know, best practice, really best practice for personal trainers, coaches, and health practitioners, and what that looks like and how we can kind of facilitate that to improve our industry as a collective. You can find out more information about the education stuff that we have on our website, which will be linked below.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, that's really it. Follow JPS Education on Instagram. It's like Jacob puts up a whole heap of, you know, great infographics. It's like, it's free. But yeah, good information. And there's a lot of other resources out there, really. That's all I have to say.
Amazing. Guys, thanks so much for joining the show today. As I said, there's so much value in today's episode. And again, Jacob, we say this every time we chat. I'd love to do this again soon. We need to set aside a few hours and just punch out a few episodes, I think. But I'll definitely have all the links to all this below for those that are listening to go and look into this more yourselves. Couldn't recommend it any higher than what I do. For those that are listening, these guys are very knowledgeable, and as Sanchez said, it's not just their own knowledge, but those collectively from some very experienced people in the industry. And if you are wanting to further your knowledge, which you should be, if your goal is to become a successful trainer and maintain that, because if you don't continue to educate yourself, then you will get left behind. I would highly recommend it. So, fellas, thanks for joining me. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day. And for those that are listening, if you have enjoyed today's episode and taken some value, please do take a screenshot of this episode and post it up on your Instagram story for me now. Tag us three. I'll have the links to the boys' Instagram below. We'd love to get some feedback on the show.
Thank you, Danny. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, heaps, man. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks, boys. Enjoy your afternoon. And thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of the Fitness and Lifestyle Podcast. Thank you very much.